I'd like to introduce our speaker. It's a privilege for me to introduce to you special guests, students, faculty, a man whom you already, many of you, most of you know, since we have been making regular use of him while he's been with us here in the St. Louis area these several months, the Reverend Dr. Henry L. Rowald. He's a graduate of Senior College Fort Wayne and of this seminary. Received his STM here in 1965 and his PhD from Christ Seminary in 1977. He served 19 years as a missionary to Taiwan, part of the time as evangelistic missionary and also in theological education there. And since 1984, he has been coordinator of mission planning and development for Southeast Asia under our Board for World Missions, or Board for Mission Services, which is certainly an exciting and a very challenging position, which includes devising strategies to assist in the growth and nurture of the Christian faith, the church in China. And so please welcome with me Dr. Rowald. You didn't get a chance to drink that much.
That's all right.
Would you kind of give me a 10-minute warning or something before we're done? So I can kind of,
Well, good morning. It's really good to be here. As Professor Kapitsky has mentioned, this is a place that was home to me more years ago than I really care to admit. In fact, so many years ago that this room that we're in right now was the library at that time, if any of you can believe that. I won't say any more. I am happy to be here, though, not simply because of any nostalgia or thinking back to old days, but because there are things happening in this world that are pretty exciting and pretty awesome, I guess would be another word, that I think it's good that we know about. And I'm happy to have that chance to be here today to share at least a little bit of that with you, namely what is happening in terms of the Christian church in China. It's a big task to talk about that. China is a country that's been around for 6,000, 7,000 years. The Christian church has been in China longer than it's been in the United States. The Christian church has gone through different kinds of trials and very strange kinds of roads in China since the time that it first was introduced there by the Nestorians back, ask your history prof about that, back in the 700s, 800s. And the last 30 years or so have really been the most exciting and the most meaningful and the most overpowering years. And it's important that we know that, because I really have a very strong conviction that we're cheating God of the praise that we should give him if we don't really understand what he has all done in this world and how he has done it in against the most unreal kinds of odds. And besides that, we're cheating ourselves as being part of the body of Christ if we don't somehow or other have a way to be edified by what has been happening to our brothers and sisters over across the waters there. Now, when I had agreed to this, I was told there'd be 50-minute time for presentation and 10 minutes for some discussion. That was to start at 10:30. By that time, Dr. Barth hadn't even started preaching yet, and the bulk of the service was still ahead of us, and I was really concerned about the total of 60 minutes that I wasn't going to have enough time, and now we have kind of squashed that a little bit. And I'm afraid I'm going to end up doing some jumping and maybe a little bit of reading, which I really don't like to do. But in order to keep it concise and to avoid the temptation of some wandering back and forth, I'm going to have to do some of that. I beg your indulgence ahead of time. To understand what has happened in the Church of China, we have to understand a little bit of history, and not just church history, but a little bit of international history there. Because back in 1949, China started on a very different course in its history. That was the year when the communists, after many years of chaos and warfare, civil war as well as the world war, that is when the communists finally became victorious in China, took China over as its place where it was going to do its thing. Now, it came with several different inner mandates that are important to understand. One of them is not a very pleasant one, at least for us to hear, and that is that China, before that time, for a good 100+ years, lived under some very unpleasant Western domination. That was a time when Western nations forced themselves into China. They forced China to grant them certain pieces of real estate, settlements so-called, in almost all of the major cities of China. They forced China to grant them sovereignty over those pieces of real estate themselves. In other words, anything that happened in the British settlement in Shanghai was not subject to Chinese law. The police were not allowed in. The military were not allowed there. It was, in other words, part of Britain that had been taken away from China and made theirs. That was a time when powers from the West were financing the expenses of their empires through many different means, but one of them was through the sale of opium. And countries from the West fought wars with China to force China to buy that opium and to use it. Those were the powers and the rulers who then on Sunday morning would kind of step back for a minute and they'd go to church and they would worship the Christian God. In other words, Christianity did not really convey a very healthy or a happy connotation to many of the people of China. Now, obviously, not all Christians were this way, and certainly not the national Christians, and certainly not the Christians there who were missionaries. And yet, protest as they may against what was going on, they were by and large ignored by the power brokers. They were also ignored by those in China who were the ones leading the nationalistic fervor of the nation of that time. And so China, the church was seen as an implant, as a religious cosmetic of a form of imperialism and colonialism that did not represent, nor was it responsive to, the aspirations or the needs of the Chinese people. Therefore, you can imagine when the Chinese communists came to power, they came with a very strong mandate in their portfolio, and that was to get rid of all of this Western influence, this Western domination, this humiliation that China had suffered, and also to get rid of that religion that these Westerners had brought with them. Of course, they had, as communists, their own ideological burden, and that was to free China not just of Christianity, but of all superstition, using their mentality now. All superstition, to rid China of anything that would keep China from taking its rightful place as leader among the nations of the world. So, in 49, that was after the Second World War, after years and years of poverty, of famine, you know, a good bit of that war was fought on Chinese soil, years of having no crops, years of no food, starvation, oppression, humiliation, nationalism, and you can name a lot of other things. After years of this kind of life, the communists came to power and they set themselves very seriously. They were welcomed by much of China and set themselves seriously to the task of remaking a China that could stand with dignity and integrity in the family of nations. Now, of course, the religious burden that they were carrying was one that was intimidating for the Christian church, because church leaders, as people who had relations with people from the West, as people who represented and led what was looked at as a foreign implant in China. Church leaders were viewed as the Chinese counterpart to the Uncle Toms, the lackeys, or term Chinese used as the running dogs of the West. And in one of its first steps, what the communist government did was to force the church to terminate all relations of any kind with the church overseas and to formulate what was called the three-self patriotic movement. Those of you who studied submissions know that the three-self idea was one that was formulated by a missionary who had served first in China and then in Korea, a man by the name of Nevius. Self-propagation, self-support, self-government. Now, in the hands of the Chinese government, what that was supposed to mean is that the church in China would get no support, would get no leadership, and would get no assistance in propagating the message from anywhere overseas. This was something they had to do for themselves, and of course, that's one of the goals of the whole three-self principle that was devised by Nevius. The problem was that when the church was reliant on the West for a lot of its financial resources and its leadership, its theological resources, and all of a sudden it was stripped of them, then that church, as you can imagine, was kind of like an orphan. It just didn't have what it needed to do the job that it knew it had to do in the face of increasingly bitter opposition from the government. And the culmination of that whole business then came a few years later, mid-60s, in the period of time that's called the Great Cultural Revolution, which was a time of just unbelievable chaos and mob rule in China. It touched every aspect of life there, but the aspect that was the target of most concerted effort was religion, and as we can understand, the Christian church. And what it did, among other things, was to confiscate all church buildings, and it turned them into warehouses and factories and whatever, and I have seen some of those, what, you know, in my trips into China, that look just beautiful, lovely church buildings, and they're pumping out thongs, or they're pumping out, you know, machinery parts or something or other. Church leaders were rounded up, and they were paraded around with dunce caps, and they were humiliated, and they were sent to prison, and they were sent out to the boonies, and a lot of them lost their lives in that process. And Bibles and hymnals and all religious literature and art and everything else was piled up and set to fire. And the intimidation was so concerted and so ruthless that it didn't take too many years until they got to the point that there was no worship service, no gatherings of any kind, no Sunday schools or Bibles or hymnals or seminaries or evangelism or anything at all. In other words, they had gotten to the point in that cultural revolution where there was no visible trace of the Christian church, and other religions too, but particularly the Christian church, in the whole of the largest nation in the world in terms of population. I can still remember one pastor saying that one of the things that really made him feel badly during those years was that, you know, he carried that dunce cap himself, if not physically, at least everyone knew he was one of these lackeys. And he said when people would come to him and try to talk to him about faith and Christianity and so on, he felt that the greatest thing he could do for them in love, that's an exaggeration, you know, but the thing that he could do that would give more love to them than anything else would be to tell them, now, stay away from me, because you associate with me, you get too close to me, and you're going to end up in prison too. Just, you know, hold off. Indication of how screwed up and how upside down the world was in those times, and those were not games that were being played. There were no niceties involved, there were no jokes, and there was never any back to normal, because this was what was normal. Anyone confessing the Christian faith was vulnerable at every point of his or her life. Kind of reminds you when you really sit back and think about it, or talk to the people there in those times, makes me think anyhow that the closest thing I can think of as a description to what that must have been like for people there was kind of like in China, in terms of the Christian church, all you had was this valley of dry bones, like Ezekiel talks about, just nothing there but lifeless, dry relics of what used to be life. Now, That's half the story. The other half the story is that, as often happens in this world, when things look the bleakest and when people stand nose up against a brick wall, that's precisely the time that God shows his power most clearly and most unmistakably, and that has happened also in China, and we don't have time to trace the history of that. Let me just give some of what is the bottom line of that. From the time that all you had was this valley of dry bones, there was nothing going on in China. Anyone who would go in would never see or smell any trace of anything Christian there. 10 years from that time, in other words, today, from the end of that great cultural revolution, 10 years from that time, still under the Communist Party, there are at present some 5,000 church buildings that have been returned to the church, and they're put to use, and they're filled up every Sunday beyond the point of full capacity. It's a church which, in addition to 5,000 buildings that are operating and functioning, has what they call worship points, which are gatherings of people, 100 plus, that do not meet in the church sanctuary, and they number those at 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 of those. It's a church that has services so packed that people come to church service hours ahead of time just to get a seat. I mean, people come banging on the church doors at 5 in the morning, if you can believe that, guys, when you graduate. 5 in the morning because they want to have a place where they can sit down, for crying out loud. It's a place where so many people want to come to the Lord's Supper in the larger churches that they have to divide the congregation into 4 groups. They code them by colors. And this week, the blues get Holy Communion, and next week, the reds get Holy Communion, because otherwise, the services would be so long that it just wouldn't be workable. It's a church where one of our Hong Kong Synod pastors, who originally came out of China, went in and was asked to preach at a church, and he did. And in good Hong Kong fashion, he preached for about 20-some minutes, and then sat down. And people looked at him and could not believe what was going on. They could not believe that anyone would finish a sermon, would have nothing more to say after 20-some minutes. And he said, hey, you can't stop now. Don't you, you know, is that it? And he said, well, yeah, it's all I prepared. They said, well, give it to us again. And he did. And he did. That's the thing. You know, this is a country where people, or a church where people are really hungry for the Word of God. This is a church where there are seminaries, 10 of them in the Protestant church, 10 of them, 10 years after there was nothing, with 600 students plus studying there. It's a church which has printed 2 million plus Bibles. It is a church which has produced its own hymnal. It is a church which is in the process of winding up a revision of the New Testament from the traditional characters into the more simplified characters and a different style of language than used to be. It is a church which publishes several journals with several magazines. It is a church, in other words, which has become, with pride and with integrity, a church that really stands very tall and very firm and very sure of the fact that God does live in this world and God does not abandon his church. It is a church that has suffered the worst of the indignities and the humiliations and the rejection that the Cultural Revolution could give a church. It took on more of the humiliation than any of the rest of society and stood firm and did what the church has always done best anywhere around the world, and that is to continue to love and to serve for the sake of Christ without condition. It has, in other words, paid its dues, terrible dues, and it has gained acceptance as Chinese. It is no longer a Western implant. It is no longer something that China needs to regurgitate to get out of its system. It is a church that fits. It belongs. It is Chinese. It has suffered with the rest of the nation and has made it and has contributions that it wants to make and can make to the nation. It is part of China. Now, part one, just to let you know some of the miracle that is going on there. It's not done yet. We haven't even begun to hear the full story of what it's all about, and certainly not in individual, you know, anecdotal terms. Still really, you know, mind-boggling. But for our purposes today, that's the introduction to part of what the church in China is today. One of the greatest miracles, we got a few church historians here, when they write their church histories 200 years from now, I guess they will do that, right? Church historians live longer. They and their colleagues will write about what is going on in China as one of the greatest miracles in the history of the Christian church, anywhere in the history of the church, anywhere in the world. Really special. Now, next step is to look beyond the miracle toward the church that we see. What kind of a church is it? What are some of the characteristics of the church? And therefore, that leads us to the next steps beyond. What are some of the challenges that it's confronting? And what are some of the ways that we in the West can be of help or of ministry to that church? And the first subsection, first thing I want to talk about in describing the church is describing some of the political context in which that church has to live. Hard for us to appreciate that because we come out of the West. Americans tend to know very little except America, and presumes that America, the rest of the world's kind of like America. But it's really very different over there. Let me go through some of that. And where should we start? All right. The church is operating, living in or under a government that has committed itself to an atheistic, materialistic ideology. The vision that the government has for the China that has the China that you want to be, when we get to the goal, that China out there, that's going to be a China that has outgrown a need for God. It is a China that operates with scientific, technological, materialistic kinds of ways of operating life, without superstition, without religion, without any of these other problems. Now, given that, which is a basic, we must say that the Constitution of the People's Republic has never forbade the existence of religion or the church. It has, in fact, expressly guaranteed that freedom, but has kind of carried it out in different kinds of ways. In the early days, the government was still consolidating its hold, and it kind of let the church flow for a little while, although it didn't take long, and that three-self patriotic movement was set up, and a comparable one for the Roman Catholic Church, the Catholic Patriotic Association. During the Cultural Revolution, of course, the church was completely forbidden, not on paper, because the Constitution still allowed it. It's just that in practice, it was not allowed at all. It was persecuted. It was actively suppressed. Today, it's very different again. Today, the church exists, and it's growing, and it's moving. And one of the things that indicates the fact that the government is changing its spirit, its attitude toward the church, can be seen from different versions of the Constitution. Back in 75, the Constitution was very, that part of it that dealt with religion was very brief. It said, citizens have freedom to believe in religion and not to believe in religion, and freedom to propagate atheism. That's short. 1982, a much more updated constitution, says this. Citizens of the PRC enjoy freedom of religious belief. Period. Two, no state organ, public organization, or individual may compel citizens to believe in or not to believe in any religion, nor may they discriminate against citizens who believe in or do not believe in any religion. Three, the state protects normal religious activities. No one may make use of religion to engage in activities that disrupt public order, impair the health of citizens, or interfere with the educational system of the state. And point four, religious bodies and religious affairs are not subject to foreign domination. The shadow of the old days still hangs pretty heavy over China. What has happened is that the government has been forced to reassess the whole role of religion and the place of religion in that society. Because if there's one thing it learned from the Cultural Revolution, it is that Religion is not going to be eradicated as quickly or as thoroughly as people had once thought. And even though it still looks at religion as anachronistic, as an opiate, yet it knows that it cannot force people to think the same way. It also knows that it cannot afford to alienate as large and as educated a segment of society as Christians and other religions do represent. Therefore, what the government has done is to adopt a principle that it calls toleration or mutual respect. Another word for that that maybe you have heard more often is the United Front. The United Front is a way of saying that, hey, we don't have to agree about everything. We can respect our different or conflicting viewpoints, but when it comes to love for our nation, to contributing our part, we'll all work together to do that. Now, what that really amounts to, and I think it's a significant change from the Cultural Revolution days, and it's only taken 10, 15 years to reach that point, is that the government is officially recognizing the validity of alternative ideologies in that monolithic government of China. And I think that bodes well for the future, because I don't think that's going to be pulled back. I think that's something that's going to grow, but that's something we'll talk about a little later again. And that's why you can have 5,000 churches, buildings returned to the church. Now, the thing is that those church buildings were being used. They were being used as factories and dormitories and movie houses or whatever. And whoever it was that was using them had to give them up. They had to go find an alternative place to do their thing. And you cannot imagine the protest that was involved by those people when they were told by the government they had to give up their church. I mean, that's a big building. You just don't find those lying around all the time. And, you know, pick them up at hardware stores. But the government did it. A couple of 3 days from now, on Sunday, if my facts are not wrong, the church in China is going to celebrate the dedication of a printing facility which has been donated in large part by the United Bible Society for the printing of Bibles in China. It's being operated in conjunction with a university there in China. And up front, you know, this is for printing of Bibles and hymnals and religious literature. Unbelievable. 10 years ago, people were encouraged, the Red Guard were encouraged by the government to get out and burn them, get into the houses, dig up under the floors, find everything that's hidden, burn the stuff. Now they're dedicating it up front. And Dr. Hoffman, who is president of the United Bible Society, is going to be there for that dedication. All right, this United Front is for real. And it has really allowed a lot of things to happen in China that were not conceivable, not even dreamable, 10, 15 years ago. That's the good news. Now the bad news, or less than happy news, is that when we talk about religious freedom, we're not really talking about the same sort of thing that we think of when we're talking in the States here. For one thing, religion in China has become, and I suspect it's probably government strategy, one of the strategies, has become an institutional phenomenon rather than a personal or a communal phenomenon. What I mean is this, that you look around in China and there are very few temples out in the villages, you know, unmanned temples, just there in case people happen to need them sometime, or out in the fields or whatever. You don't have those anymore. They just don't exist. The government does not allow them. And the people, the shamans, or the local priests and nuns and whatever that used to man those buildings, they're not around anymore either. Because what the government has said is that religion is confined to the major religions that exist. That's Taoism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam, and they somehow separate Roman Catholic and Protestant. These are allowed to exist within certain parameters. But folk religion, that is religion down on the elemental level, has been pretty well blocked off. Religion has been, in that sense, sort of divorced from the agricultural cycle, been divorced from the cycle of birth and marriage and death, you know, when traditionally religion was a very important part of life. and has become institutionalized. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect is that the government has set some pretty tight boundaries around the church. People in the States, many are very, from all different parts of the ballpark, are very much committed to the principle of separation of church and state. And who isn't? You very rarely could even conceive of something that would not have any aspect of that. But there would not be many that would envy the kind of separation that exists over in China. Because what it means there is that the church has freedom to conduct religious activities only within the confines of religious buildings and only by authorized people. This, together with that constitutional provision we just heard that says no one can coerce another person to believe in anything, means that in China at present, there is no such thing as infant baptism. There are no Sunday schools. The church doesn't operate any school of any kind from kindergarten all the way up through university. The church is not allowed to intrude on the government's role to run hospitals, to operate social or welfare types of agencies. The church is not allowed on the radio. The church is not allowed any active evangelistic program outside of the church walls. The church, in other words, has kind of been confined to the building. And the government, I wonder if this isn't one of the long-term unspoken strategies, seems to be building that wall around the church higher. They may have the building, and the cross sticking up and everything, but the wall around it is so high that you really wonder if one of the real crucial crises that the church in China has got to deal with is not the question of what in the world is the church anyway? Is it simply a gathering of religiously inclined people who are going to die off sooner or later? Or does it have something to do with day in, day out life? Does it have something to do with open society out there? And if so, how do you link it up? How do you fit it? Can it be that the government is, by keeping the wall high and the children out of the church, trying to find a way to tolerate the church, but also to confine it in such a way that it will simply die a very prolonged, but natural, unprotested, maybe even unnoticed death? Talk about a crisis. That is really a big one that weighs heavy on the hearts of Christians and particularly Christian leaders over in China. All right, other characteristics or other aspects to the church. Another thing that's characteristic of that church there is that it is a very diverse church, much more so than is true of our churches here in the States. And that is because China is such a diverse country. It is divided into unbelievable numbers of language groups and subcultures just all over the place, and people from the north really can't speak to the people from the south. And the problem is that China doesn't have the travel or the communication infrastructure to make that easy. And therefore, the church is growing in different parts of the country in totally, almost independent directions. And this has been, the problem has taken on added depth in the fact that after the Cultural Revolution, the church in these different areas of China kind of all sprang up spontaneously. It was not a mass movement, a coordinated mass movement in China. Here was a church that all of a sudden got its building, and here was a church that all of a sudden could, have its worship and so on. And each place had a different kind of set of government officials it had to deal with. It operated at a different pace. It had different needs, different kinds of church leaders, different quality of leadership. And so the church in different parts of China, my goodness, you cannot imagine the diversity that is there. And one of the biggest internal problems the church has is trying to find a way to coordinate this. In fact, at present, the church there doesn't even call itself the Christian Church in China. There is no organization or structure called the Christian Church or Protestant. That's in Chinese language, those two are almost synonymous. All they are right now is a Christian council of churches, an association, and very loose, very diverse. And another aspect to that is the denominational. The church right now does not know denominational barriers. We'll talk about that in a minute. It does not allow them. But the leaders of the church, those before 1949, were all trained in denominational seminaries. And so you got Anglicans and Baptists and Methodists and Pentecostals and the whole wide range, and a lot of them feel very strong loyalties to their traditions and their doctrines and their practices and so on. And what the church in China has simply tried to do is to adapt the government's policy of tolerance and mutual respect and to open the doors wide enough so that almost anything will go, as long as it doesn't flagrantly contradict scripture or, you know, represent some innovation in church history or something. Kind of anything goes. But it means that there is this unbelievable cultural diversity, also theological, even denominational diversity in this big country of China. Another characteristic concerns what I just mentioned before about the church being post-denominational. That is the word that they use with most enthusiasm when they talk about themselves. They are beyond denominations. Now, that carries a couple of aspects of meaning that it's important that we understand. One is this, that when they use the word post-denominational, it means, for one thing, the separation of the church in China from what it views as the Western domination of the church. Not the Babylonian captivity, but the Western captivity, the Latin captivity of the Christian church, and the consequent fracturing of the church into denominations. From their point of view, that fracturing may be due to historical causes, or political, or national, or linguistic, or cultural, or theological. Who knows what kind of causes, and it's always a mixed bag, but the thing is that almost all of these causes, from their point of view, are unrelated to anything that has ever happened in China. Therefore, for a church to import into China, in addition to the gospel, the fracturing of the church, and to divide one Chinese co-worker from another one, so that they can't even work together, this is a form of domination that China, the church in China, cannot afford. It cannot, in view of the fact that it is dealing with a hostile government and a strongly non-Christian society, cannot afford the luxury of that sort of fracturing. Therefore, it says we will not allow denominations. We will be Christian or Protestant. Another aspect of it is historical, and that is that when these Christians came under communist rule, all churches, of course, were forced to leave. All support was gone, and those Christians were orphaned. Therefore, they had to find ways and resources to stand on their own against the onslaughts that came. And particularly in the time of the Great Cultural Revolution, they stood very, very, very much alone. They had no one but each other to provide the kind of support in the body of Christ that they needed. And therefore, they felt that these denominational differences somehow, when you get down to the very bottom of the well, they don't really matter anymore. And besides that, 40 years, my goodness, you got a couple of generations of Christians that never knew denominations. They never grew, they never experienced all of that. Therefore, when they talk about post-denominational, they are really saying that, hey, we're on a different track. We're part of a different culture. We have had a different history, and we want to try to maintain as much as possible the unity that God gives the Christian church and has blessed us with in our bleak days. We want to try to maintain that as much as we possibly can. And you hear them talk about that, and you stand on the side and you say, baby, right on. You know, if you can pull that off, man, what a beautiful thing that would be, and what a great testimony to the rest of the world. You know, you link that together with your Christian witness, and boy, it's powerful. The thing is that it ain't that easy, because we mentioned before that you do have all of these denominational traditions. And you do have Baptists, and you have Seventh-day Adventists, and you have Anglicans and Pentecostals, and across the board. And the policy that the church has used of toleration, mutual respect, and so on, that's fine if all you're dealing with is adiaphora. You know, the superficial practices, the way you go about running a church. But, by golly, you're not going to talk a Baptist into thinking that baptism by sprinkling is going to be valid. You know, and you're not going to talk a Seventh-day Adventist into thinking that it doesn't matter if you worship on Saturday or Sunday. And no way, unless you are demanding by the principle of tolerance, compromise. That's where the real rub is going to come. And I spent some time on several occasions talking with some church leaders, trying to press the question, you know, about this. What are the implications of this easily phrased tolerance? Now, my real concern was not the baptism, the sprinkling, or the worship on Sunday, but the question of infant baptism, which to Lutherans, you know, is non-negotiable. Baptism is baptism. It doesn't matter how old they are. On what basis do you give that up? Where is the role of theology in deciding that we will not have baptism? In other words, the danger, there are two dangers, but the one of them is that theology almost becomes irrelevant in the church. It becomes an addendum, a nicety that you give to the scholars, but it really has very little to do with the church. And the second point is what's going to happen is that the church is going to be so weakened that it has very little in the way of theological conviction on the basis of which they can talk to the government or deal with the rising flood of sectarian, schismatic, heretical little groups that are springing up in the Christian church all over China. How can you deal with them if you don't have theology unless you're reduced simply to dealing as an institution? Kind of like the Roman Catholic Church, sort of. So, is the church there really post-denominational? It's really a hard one. In one sense, they are, and they want to be. And in one sense, you know, I can really appreciate that. And you pray that God leads them along that path. At the same time, you kind of have the feeling, you don't say it out loud, but you kind of have the question, you wonder if the church isn't at the same time pre-denominational. Because they're going to face some problems. They need our prayers. All right, how are we doing on time, Harley? I got about 25 minutes worth of talk here in 5 minutes yet. And I'll try to just skim over a few things and leave some time for questions. One of the crises of the church is its leadership. A real headache. They have got 3,000 plus pastors. 3,000 plus pastors. We mentioned 5,000 plus churches. Now, that's not ideal to begin with. The thing is that 3,000 plus pastors has an average age of about, this year, 68. Which means that within 5 or 10 years, China, statistically speaking, the church there, runs the risk of losing one half to two thirds of its clergy. Can you imagine that? One half to two thirds of its clergy. It also means when you're dealing with a clergy at that age level, average age level, you're dealing with people who are not able to run an aggressive program of any kind often in the church. Obviously, the evangelism is not going to be done the same way as it can be. It's got seminaries there. They've got 600 students. And you praise God for that because somehow in 10 years, it came from the point of having no seminaries to having 600 students, you know, willing to devote themselves to a form of life that does not get a whole lot of governmental recognition. 600 students. But if you would devote that entire 600 students, they graduate 200 a year. That's about what the average is, three-year curriculum, 200 a year. You're going to spend the first 15 to 20 years simply replacing the pastors that are presently on the rolls, assuming that you don't lose any of those younger ones. And it says nothing about the new churches that are coming into the church, the new ones being built, these worship points, any expansion of the church. You're not talking about any specialized ministries in the church. Talk about a crisis. They got a big one. They really do. And when you talk to them, they zero in immediately on their number one priority is we gotta train people. Now, those who are taking up the slack are the lay people. Praise the Lord for them. They are, in fact, the ones that really held the church together through those dark, bleak days. Because the clergy, you know, were all bottled up in prisons or wherever. It was the lay people that really held things together, and they still do. And if you got 3,000-plus clergy and 5,000-plus congregations, you know there are 2,000-plus that are not being served by a pastor. And, in fact, some of those churches have more than one pastor. You're talking about at least one half of the church now, congregations being served by laity. Now, that's great, you know, and that is one of the reasons why the church is as strong as it is and some of the other religions are not. And one of the reasons why the Protestant church is much stronger than the Roman Catholic church. But, by golly, if this laity does not have any training in the scriptures, any training in Christian theology, any understanding of what Christian ministry is all about, that is where the church is running into its crisis of all of these sects, these schismatic, separatistic, heretical sects that are embarrassing the life out of the church because they carry the name Christian, but they're under no one's supervision. And here it's the church leadership that has no clout, you know, no way to touch him, but somehow has to try to explain to society and to the government, hey, that's really not what we're all about. Talk about a crisis. They got a big one. Okay, and I think a few others I'm just going to skip over and say a couple of comments about what we in the Western Church can do in or for that church there. One thing we have to realize, one thing that I think really deserves mention, and that is that I think we in our church have owe to God a very strong sense of gratitude for those people in China, both Chinese and expatriate, who poured their lives out for the sake of the gospel, planted that seed, and then were, in one form or another, rejected, you know, kicked out of China, imprisoned, or whatever, killed in the process. They planted that seed, and boy, we went through a period of time when it looked like the whole thing was a loss. He just write it off. It was a terrible, bad investment. But really, it's only now that that seed is beginning really to come into fruit. And it is beautiful, and it has hardly even begun yet. And I think that we need to be proud of what we as the Missouri Synod did as part of that. And also thank God for other Christian fellowships that have done the same. That church is strong because of the seed that was planted and that seed that under God's blessing nourished them in those bleak days. That's one thing. Another thing is that church has asked us, hey, stay away for a little while. Give us a little distance. Give us some freedom to gain our identity as a Chinese church. Don't give people the impression that once the heat is off, you know, then you're going to come back and you're going to run things again. We're going to have to find ways to deal with your money and we've got to do something with all these missionaries that you send over. Just stay away for a while. Let us get on our feet. And that's been a hard one to deal with because that certainly is not something that Westerners like to hear, you know, and certainly not we who operate with a mentality that looks at the world as a place where we like to have buttons, you know, all over that say this country is ours and this one is ours, but that one isn't. But I think it's important that we respect that. I think it's important that we realize that they are speaking those words under some intense pressure. And they often must speak words that they would not necessarily want to speak if they had control over their own fate. But that's where they're at. So, you do what you can do. Now, one of the things is that the church is really opening up and allowing an unbelievable number of ways where people who have developed a sense of relationship and integrity with them are able to be of service. There are ways to send in people with different forms of expertise. There are ways to share theological resources. They're sending students, you know, future professors out to Western countries for advanced training. There are all different kinds of ways that the church is beginning to open up and say, hey, we know that we are Chinese. We also want to be part of the whole body of Christ and really express that. We just have to be, for the present, very patient, give mountains of prayers to the Lord for them, and bide our time, build our bridges, and a day is going to come, I think, much quicker than we think, when there's going to be some really healthy, fine relationships that are built. And I really hope that before too many years go by, we at Concordia Seminary here can have one or two or who knows how many students from the People's Republic as part of our Christian fellowship here at Concordia. I really look forward to that. All right, I've gone over, and I apologize. I just share the common clerical malady of a mouth that keeps running. But I think there's time for one or two questions, maybe.
We certainly apologize to you for the time constraints that we're operating with here, but we will take one question and a half. Anyone?
Where on?
Well, one of the main things, as far as I'm concerned, is that the church has paid its dues and it has become Chinese. It is no longer seen, even by its most hostile enemies in China, as an import or as part of someone else's baggage. They are an integral part of China.
Well, thank you, Dr. Rowald. We certainly appreciate this information.